If you go to the tiny town of Groton, New York, and you drive halfway down Main Street, you will see, perched on your left, as you head toward the American Legion, not as you head toward the post office, you'll see perched on your left on a little hill just up above Main Street, a lovely old Greek Revival building. It looks exactly like what it was built as back in the 20s, a high school. It served in that capacity for decades and then passed through a number of other incarnations when a new school was built. These days it's called Schoolhouse Gardens and is an apartment complex for the elderly and those living with disabilities. The carefully restored exterior, the well-maintained lawns, the huge old shady trees, the kindly seniors sitting on the benches out front, the little plaque they just put up that proclaims that the building has been listed on the National Register of Historic Places will all present a most charming picture. You will see no evidence at all that this building has a dark and sinister past. Sort of. During the years of my growing up, the building had been long abandoned. Dirty, foreboding, empty, the windows having succumbed to decades of children's well-aimed stones, the old high school, as we called it, was a creepy reminder of a more prosperous past. By the time of the Troubles, I and my friends had not yet reached the age where we would have dared each other to enter a place like that, and so I had never gone inside. But you know who had gone inside? Bored teenagers. Looking for a place to party, safe from the prying eyes of authority figures, the kids had found a way to break in and had left their mark. Now, these were the days of hard music, heavy metal and thrash metal and death metal, with all their pseudo-evil pomps and posings, were the preferred way to rebel in those days. And so, as proof of their allegiance to all things tough and bad, the teenagers left not only empty beer cans, but walls covered with anarchy symbols, and inverted pentagrams and drawings of hands in the classic rock and roll devil's horns position. One day, a cat, looking for a place to die, found her lonely way into the old high school and expired in one of the classrooms. I hope that her death was peaceful. I am sure she had no idea of the frenzy that it would cause. For you see, sometime after her death, some adults, having found the way that the teenagers were getting in and decided to board it up, discovered the place where she had curled up and breathed her last breath, right under the place where some drunk teenager had written "Hail Satan" in blood-red paint on the wall. It was like a bomb had gone off in Groton. The rumors spread like wildfire, and soon everyone had heard the terrible news. There were Satanists in Groton, and they were sacrificing cats in the old high school. The police, the village council, the school board all girded themselves to do battle against the forces of darkness. Police patrols were doubled. Notes were sent home with students. A curfew was instituted for everyone under the age of 18. Known troublemakers were questioned. News outlets reported. Parents kept their children and their cats behind closed doors. Rumors flew and grew. My friend Teddy swore that he had broken into the school the day before the parents who had found the cat. And he wanted me to know that it was all a cover-up. It wasn't, in fact, a dead cat at all. It was a dead human baby covered with human teeth marks. He had seen it with his own eyes. Suspicion infected the town. Everyone wondered who among us might be Satan's henchpersons. I, for one, was convinced that my older sister was definitely in on it. As far as I was concerned, she was totally evil minion material. Never had there been such excitement in my town. I don't know how the adults felt, but we kids loved it. It was like a real-life horror movie had come to life, and I went to bed every night hoping that some new terror would come to light. But it never did. Despite the suspicion, despite the best efforts of the authorities, no one was ever caught. Eventually, since no demons were ever spotted in town and no portal to hell ever opened up under the school, and all the other elderly stray cats had the sense to die in less scandalous places, the frenzy died down. Life returned to normal. The town began to raise money to renovate the old high school, and now that former den of evil is Schoolhouse Gardens, and some elderly pensioner lives in the very same room where Groton's only known black mass never actually happened. It's worth noting that this all happened just as a wave of moral panic was sweeping the nation in the mid-80s. Having gotten over our collective fear of cults for a while, the nation's moral imagination turned to Satanism and ritual abuse. We were not alone in Groton. My partner Terry, who grew up in the next town over from me, will swear to you that they were ritually abusing cats in his town. My cousins, who grew up in the next town in the other direction, will tell you it happened in their town. So what was it that everyone was so afraid of? Who is Satan? Why is he so scary to so many people? Jesus claims that he's the one that kept that woman bound and bent over in half for 18 years, who kept her staring at the dirt, unable to even look at the sky. Earlier in the story, Luke says that Satan's the one that tempted Jesus in the desert. Later, Luke will claim that he's the same one that would enter into Judas and lead him to betray the Messiah. The devil has been the source of endless Christian, Jewish, and Muslim speculation. Writers and artists from Dante to Bosch to Milton to the creators of South Park have taken him as their subject. There are Christians in the world that cannot imagine believing in a good God without believing in an equally evil opposite number. Through time and across the Christian world, the devil has been a huge and a very real presence in the lives of many, maybe even most, believers. So why does he matter? Well, the Hebrew word Satan means simply adversary. Likewise, the Greek word diabolos, from which we get the word devil, means roughly one who throws something across the path. In the earliest layer of recorded Jewish tradition, the word was applied to different people, including King David, to the enemies of Israel, and to others. The adversary, the Satan, was usually used in context of war or a legal battle. From time to time, as in the story of Job, a character named the Satan, the adversary, capital T, capital A, crops up. This character seems to have been not the opposite of God, not evil, but a member of God's staff. Some sort of functionary in the divine court. In the book of Job, the Satan comes to his boss, God, and they have a conference about Job's holiness, or lack thereof. It seems that in the period covered by the books of the Old Testament, there was no sense of an evil intelligence counter to God's, and the Satan is not an important figure at all, getting barely a handful of mentions. However, in the 400 or so years between the last writings of the Hebrew scriptures and the first writing of the Christian ones, this understanding began to change. At first, some claimed that God had appointed Satan, which was becoming a proper noun at this time, had appointed Satan as the tempter. It was Satan's job to tempt you to sin and then report you to God if you did, and then it was God's job to punish you. In the stories, Satan was always secretly rooting for you to do the right thing. It's his job to tempt you, they said, and he has to do his level best, but he really does want you to win. These commentators felt sorry for him for having such a crummy job. Where before the whole earth was God's good realm, Jewish thinkers at about this time seem to have begun seeing the earth as a battleground between opposing and equally powerful good and evil forces. Some began reading an evil Satan back into existing stories. For these guys, Satan had become totally a bad guy, no good in him. It was he that entered the serpent and tempted Eve, they said. He that convinced David to seduce Bathsheba, they said. He that told Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, they said. They also began to generate stories of his provenance. One story follows on a strange passage in the 6th chapter of the book of Genesis, in which some figures, called simply the sons of God, look down from heaven, fall in love with human women, and mate with them, producing a race of giant half-breeds. These Jewish thinkers hypothesized that God had cast the sons of God out of heaven for crossbreeding, and that Satan, of course, was their ringleader, ever after trying to bring down God's reign. Another story reinterprets a passage in Isaiah, in which the powerful king of Babylon falls from power. This passage says in part, quote, "How you have fallen from heaven, O day star, O son of dawn, down to the depths of the pit," end quote. Those later thinkers came up with a story in which Satan is, again, a high-ranking official in the divine court. He leads some sort of rebellion, for what reason exactly is the source of much speculation. But he leads some sort of rebellion, and he and his followers are cast down to hell, again, ever after, to try to bring down the realm of heaven and anyone who might support or love it. Incidentally, Satan gets another of his names from this story. Daystar and Son of Dawn were both names for Venus, the morning star, and another name for Venus is Lightbringer, which in Latin is Lucifer. By the time of the New Testament writings, the world, and in fact all of history, have become a great battleground between the opposing forces of good and evil in the eyes of Jewish and later Christian thinkers. The idea of the devil as God's chief enemy and opposite number has become firmly entrenched in the Jewish religious imagination. It's commonplace at this time to claim that one's religious enemies were in the grip of his evil machinations. This would, in fact, become a favorite strategy of small splinter or reform groups who split off from a parent faith and were then persecuted for it. The Essenes did it. The Jesus movement did it. The first Christians, they all called the Jewish religious leadership of their day satanic. Centuries later, the Protestants would take equating the Pope with Satan and literally turn it into an art form. But back to the first century. Satan is mentioned by name 35 times in the New Testament, but has lots of other titles as well. The prince of demons, the prince of the powers of the air, the ruler of the darkness of the age, the enemy, the evil one, tempter, adversary, father of lies, murderer, liar, deceiver, accuser. He shows up as a dragon in the book of Revelation and as the one that incites Judas to betray Jesus. Life would get so hard for Paul and for the other early Christians that they would come to declare that the devil had in fact won control of the entire world. They called him things like the prince of the powers of this world. They said that all there was for good people to do was hunker down, suffer bravely, behave well, don't lose the faith, and wait for God to reveal the great cosmic plan and conquer through Jesus Christ. Notice this. In all the stories of the devil's origins, he never starts as an outsider. He's not some other god that comes to challenge our God. He's not from some other dimension trying to break into this one and take it over. In every story, he starts as a trusted, powerful insider. The stories imply that it is exactly that he is an insider and has turned coat. That is exactly the thing that makes him so dangerous. Satan always stands for the near adversary, the intimate enemy. For some, he was the Jewish secular leadership who had sold out in the Hellenized world. Later, he was the leadership of the Jerusalem temple, too cosmopolitan, too accommodated to the Roman Empire. Later, he was the Pope. Later, he was Christians like us who support gay marriage. And on and on. Satan is always the us that somebody else thinks has gone wrong. The story doesn't say that Satan entered Pontius Pilate far away in a palace. It says he entered Judas Iscariot standing right next to Jesus. The story doesn't say that Jesus faced the devil's temptation in the middle of Jerusalem, surrounded by people. It says he faced it in the desert, alone with his own thoughts. Satan is an insider, the stories say. He's one of us. He is us. He is the personification, the mythological personification of every worst impulse in every system or government or religion or group or person. He is the intimate enemy, the weak link, the fatal flaw that has the power to bring us down. He's not the one that forces us to do bad things. He's the part of us that exults in doing bad things. Is he real? In the sense of a physical guy with horns and hoofs, or in the sense of an actual being that you could touch or interact with, I wish he would be easier to avoid then. But of course he's not real in that way. Is he real, though, in the sense that the world can feel like a battlefield and the worst enemy is the nearest one, and temptation and betrayal are all around, and the worst sins are often committed with a grin and a sense of triumph? You look at the world and at history, and then you tell me. God and Satan are not two sides of the same coin. They are not some matched set where one has no value without the other. Spare me your analogies about how light can't exist without darkness or warmth can't exist without cold. They don't fly. With or without Satan, God is God and God is good and God is real and God does not have or need an opposite number. Our faith would still make sense without Satan. And yet, you know as well as I do that temptation is real. That some people live entire lives bent over, staring at the dirt, bound there by the oppression of others or by their own choices. You know that teenagers can do stupid stuff like breaking into old buildings and painting crap on the walls, and you know that you and I and cats will die. You know that betrayal happens, and our worst selves sometimes win, that the mighty can fall, and that it's easy to find yourself trapped in a life of bitterness. So there is at least that much truth in the stories about Satan. But here's what today's story says. No matter how bent over, for how long, no matter how bound, no matter by what, no matter whether there's a cosmic battle going on or not, the people are going to end up free, looking at the sky, not at the dirt, and praising God. Here's what the story says. God is going to win. Here's what today's story says. Whether Satan is real or not, he's going down. Say amen.